translation. The king, not received by any formal welcome, by means of being offered a seat, a place, water, and sweet addresses, considered himself neglected, and so thinking, he became angry. So to repeat, the king, not received by any formal welcome, by means of being offered a seat, a place, water, and sweet addresses, considered himself neglected, and so thinking, he became angry. So purport, by his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The law of reception in the codes of the Vedic principles states that even if an enemy is received at home, he must be received with all respects. He should not be given a chance to understand that he has come into the house of an enemy. When Lord Krishna, accompanied by Arjun and Bhim, approached Jarasandh in Magadha, the respectable enemies were given a royal reception by King Jarasandh. One guest enemy, namely Bhim, was to fight with Jarasandh, and yet they were given a grand reception. At night, they used to sit down together as friends and guests. And in the day, Bhima and Jarasandh would fight, risking life and death. This was the law of reception. The reception law enjoins that a poor man who has nothing to offer his guest should be good enough to offer a straw mat for sitting, a glass of water for drinking, and some sweet words. Therefore, to receive a guest, either friend or foe, there is no expense. It is only a question of good manners. When Maharaj Parikshit entered the door of Shamik Rishi, he did not expect a royal reception by the Rishi because he knew that saints and Rishis are not materially rich men. But he never expected that a seat of straw, a glass of water, and some sweet words would be denied to him. He was not an ordinary guest, nor was he an enemy of the Rishi. And therefore, the cold reception by the Rishi astonished the king greatly. As a matter of fact, the king was right to get angry with the Rishi when he needed a glass of water very badly. To become angry in such a grave situation was not unnatural for the king. But because the king himself was not less than a great saint, his becoming angry and taking action were astonishing. So it must be accepted that it was ordained by the supreme will of the Lord. The king was a great devotee of the Lord, and the saint was also as good as the king. But by the will of the Lord, the circumstances were so created that they became ways to the king's becoming unattached to family connection and governmental activities, and thus becoming a completely surrendered soul unto the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. The merciful Lord sometimes creates such awkward positions for his pure devotee in order to drag the devotee towards himself from the mire of material existence. But outwardly, this situation appears to be frustrating the devotee. The devotee of the Lord is always under the protection of the Lord, and in any condition, frustration or success, the Lord is the supreme guide for the devotee. The pure devotee, therefore, accepts all conditions of frustration as blessings from the Lord. I'll reread the translation one more time. The king, not received by any formal welcome by means of being offered a seat, a place, water, and sweet addresses, considered himself neglected, and so thinking, he became angry. So a very interesting verse, a very instructive and informative purport, and a critical part of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So to begin today's class, though, I am going to take a slight sidebar, and you'll understand why, hopefully, at the completion of this class. And I'd like to take you on a journey with me back about 10 years. And almost to the day, actually, April 2021, it was about April or May 2011. And I had only just started traveling with His Holiness Bhakti Charaswami. And at that time, it was my first visit to Srila Prabhupada's Palace of Gold in New Vrindavan in West Virginia. Now, I was kind of overwhelmed by the experience. I don't know how many of you have been to the Palace of Gold or if you've seen the Palace of Gold. But it is quite a phenomenal place. And it's phenomenal for two reasons. I mean, number one is just the magnitude. It's golden, it's elaborate, it's in the middle of nowhere. But number two is that it's such an inhospitable place for a tribute of this size to have been erected to commemorate Srila Prabhupada. You know, it's mountainous, the terrain is not conducive, there's a lot of mud. And beyond that, people who know West Virginia, it's quite a tough blue collar, you know, the main industry there is coal, the people are kind of burly and brash. And yet in the midst of this kind of inhospitable situation, there is this beautiful, exquisite temple which is being dedicated to Srila Prabhupada. So I was overwhelmed with two emotions at that time, and it sticks with me. Number one was that the devotees who had developed this Palace of Gold were of a caliber, of a dedication, of a devotion to their Guru Maharaj and to this mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that I couldn't fully fathom. You know, many of them were the age that I was then, in my early 20s, maybe not much older than 30. And the second thing which struck me was something that my father had told me when he was with Srila Prabhupada in 1977, which is in October, he was massaging Srila Prabhupada's feet. Srila Bhakti Charaswami was also there. And Prabhupada kind of gestured that he wanted to say something. And he said, "I've given you this big, big ISKCON movement. Please try and expand it. At least maintain it. Do not let it diminish." And then Srila Prabhupada started shedding tears. And he said, everybody in that room, even the hardened managers, they also started to shed tears to see Srila Prabhupada's mood like this. So all of these things struck me all at once. And I was thinking, how, you know, maybe for this generation who can build in West Virginia, who can carry on the mantle of their Guru Maharaj so strongly, maybe for them it is possible, but how are we going to take responsibility? And actually, Srila Bhakti Charu Maharaj overheard me and he asked me to repeat. And so I repeated my feelings to him that I don't know how we are going to take responsibility. How are we going to follow in the footsteps of the previous generation? And he looked at me and he said, "This is a very good point. This is a very good point." And he looked me in the eyes and he said, "To the degree that you take on responsibility for this movement, to that degree, you will be empowered by the previous acharyas." So the reason that I bring this up is really because I'm having many of those same feelings now. 10 years has gone like this. And here we are, certainly in the Bhaktivedanta Mani community. In that time, look at the devotees who have passed on. We have Jivapati Prabhu. We have Mother Kalangana, Shruti Dharma Prabhu. Even Srila Bhakti Charu Maharaj, who was the shelter of hundreds of devotees there at the Bhaktivedanta Mani, has now departed. And yet, so you could say that this is kind of an inhospitable circumstance. What to couple with that, we're in lockdown. Many devotees can't even come to the temple. I don't think I've gone this long in my life without spending time chanting japa in front of the deities. And yet, in spite of all of those difficulties, in spite of the most inhospitable circumstances, here we are today. And my Dandavat pranams to all the devotees there at the Bhaktivedanta Mani, because you have taken on responsibility. You have adapted to the inhospitable circumstance. This pandemic situation is your West Virginia, and you are creating this palace of gold for Srila Prabhupada by expanding this Sankirtan mission, by taking on responsibility. You have vindicated what Srila Bhakti Charu Maharaj said, that to the degree that you take on responsibility, to that degree, you will become empowered. And I know certainly that the Hare Krishna explosion, as Sureshwara Prabhu often called it, that happened around Srila Prabhupada, maybe we won't emulate those heights, but maybe we can at least do justice. At least we can try our level best, and the mercy of the Acharyas will rain forth on us. So my Dandavat pranams unto all of the devotees there at Bhaktivedanta Mani. I wish I could see you right now, but I know that you are there. I know that hopefully, I won't say I know, but hopefully it won't be too much longer until I can be there and serve you all soon. But again, my Dandavat pranams unto you all. So in addressing today's verse, quite clearly, Srila Prabhupada, at the beginning of the purport, he's talking about etiquette. And when I first thought about how to prepare for this class, I was going to make it predominantly about Vaishnava Sadachar, Vaishnava etiquette. And I will touch upon that point as my third point, actually, today. But before we go into Vaishnava Sadachar and the importance of etiquette, and I will touch upon, you know, the magnus opus, Sanatan Goswami's Hari Bhakti Vilas, his commentary on that Digdarshini, Manu Samhita, and what they can teach us with regard to this very important pastime in Srimad Bhagavatam. Before I get into that, I want to talk about two other points. The first point that I'm going to discuss is how astonishing this pastime is. Srila Prabhupada mentions that Bhriksha Maharaj's reaction is astonishing, how he's being frustrated, how this is the will of the Lord, and really elaborate on this pastime and put it into context of what we can learn from it and how we can apply that into our life. But even before I start to look at Parikshit Maharaj, the first point I want to discuss is the overall importance of the first canto. And this is something which, only in preparation of this class, I think is beginning to awaken within me somewhat. Because, you know, I don't think I'd actually reread or read the preface of the Srimad Bhagavatam since, in fact, I mean, I can't remember a time since I actually first acquired my first set. And actually, that was a memorable day. There was a devotee who's probably very well known to you all, Sutapa Prabhu, who was actually Sandeep Prabhu back then. It was April of 2006. A lot of things happening in April. April or May, maybe it was May, it was just after my exams had finished. So May 2006. And I remember I came to the temple. And I pre-arranged with Sandeep Prabhu, Sutta Prabhu, to collect my Srimad Bhagavatam. And actually, I brought my nanny along with me. And it was such a memorable day because when Sutta Prabhu handed me, it was the small set of Srimad Bhagavatam, this size. So Sutta Prabhu handed me the two boxes. And he saw that my nanny was with me. And Sutta Prabhu said, "Oh, is that your mother?" I said, "No, that's my grandmother." And he said, "Oh, does she live with you?" And I said, "No, she doesn't actually. She lives quite close by." So she said, "Maybe she would like a set of Bhagavatams too." And I thought for the first time I saw in action the voracious appetite of Sankirtan devotees for book points and luxury points. But anyway, that stuck in my mind. That was a very sweet memory with Sutta Prabhu. So anyway, I went home, unboxed the Srimad Bhagavatam. And it was actually the set of Bhagavatam where the 10th canto says Krishna, Krishna. And there isn't an 11th and 12th, just says Krishna in the 10th canto. So I saw those books and by some chance, I actually pulled out the Krishna first. And of course, as somebody just coming to devotional life, I was like, well, Krishna is the goal, isn't it? But I resisted the temptation to open it up and I started stacking the books on from Krishna all the way down to the first canto. And then I opened up the first canto and I started reading the preface. And in my mind, I was thinking, okay, after I've done this, I'm going to crack open the Krishna book. And I read in that preface that the only qualification one needs to study this great book of transcendental knowledge is to proceed step by step cautiously and not jump forward haphazardly as with an ordinary book. It should be gone through chapter by chapter, one after another. And I thought, why did I open up this book? I looked along the shelf, but you know, I was a law student, so I thought, okay, no problem. I know how to read. I've got through that. I can get through this, and ultimately, I'll get to Krishna. So that was my mentality going into it, and that is how I approach the Srimad Bhagavatam. That okay, you know, this is good. It's purifying. It's like a necessary austerity, and ultimately, I'll get to my destination, which is the 10th canto. It's kind of a rolling up my sleeves kind of situation. And of course, in the course of reading it, I found plenty of other cantos that I appreciate, fourth and fifth until this day. That's my go-to, seventh, even parts of the ninth canto, and then ultimately 10th, 11th. But I think even until this time, there was a subtle residual feeling that there are highlights within the Srimad Bhagavatam, and there are the supporting acts, should we say. But then, when I was preparing, I came across a quote from Well, I actually found out that this feeling is more commonplace than you may think, and maybe more prevalent amongst devotees and even amongst commentators. In fact, there was a body of scholars who wanted to actually discredit the first and second canto and say, you know, these are not actually part of Srimad Bhagavatam. That the first canto, because Shukadev Goswami doesn't speak until the second canto, the first canto isn't really technically speaking part of the Bhagavatam. And the second canto, well, Shukadev Goswami only mentions the 10 topics towards the end of the canto. So really, we should start from the third. But then Jiva Goswami, in his Krama Sandarbha commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam, he annihilates this kind of mayic tendency, this mundane tendency to approach Srimad Bhagavatam. And he says, actually, all of the topics of the Bhagavatam are contained within all of the different cantos. It doesn't matter that Shukadev Goswami has just explicitly stated it. And he goes on to elaborate in what way that is true. So I realized that, okay, I wasn't saying it wasn't part of the Bhagavatam, but maybe I was also harboring that feeling that, you know, this is a mayic tendency, that the first canto isn't so important. And why do I labor this point? I labor this point because this view is also emphatically endorsed by the Padma Purana. Pado yadiyo pratama dvititya tritiya turyo katito yaduru. Na bistata panchama eva shashto punchantaram dor yukalam tatanyo kantastura janabamo yadiyo mukaravindam dasama prafulam ekadasho yasya lala tapatam shiro pitu dvadasha eva bhati tamadidevam karuna nidhanam tamalavanam suhitavataram apara samsara samudra setum bhajamahe bhagavata swarupam bhajamahe bhagavata swarupam bhajamahe bhagavata swarupam. So the first and second cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam are Sri Krishna's lotus feet. The third and fourth cantos are his thighs. The fifth canto is his navel. The sixth, his chest. The seventh and eighth, his arms. The ninth, his throat. The tenth, his beautiful lotus face. The 11th canto is his forehead. And the 12th canto is his head. I bow down to that Lord, the ocean of mercy, whose color is like that of a tamal tree, and who appears in this world for the welfare of all. I worship him as a bridge for crossing the unfathomable ocean of material existence. The Bhagavatam has appeared as his very self. The Bhagavatam is the Lord, and the first and second cantos are his feet. And if you meditate on that, I mean, you know, Mother Earth is lamenting just two chapters before that the lotus feet of the Lord will no longer decorate her. Maharaj Kulashekar, our own acharyas, how many thousands of verses do they write extolling the glories of the Lord's feet? And what does Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu say? Ai nanda tanuja kinkaram patita mam vishame bhavambudo kripaya tava pada pankaja stita duli sadrisham vichintaya. Kripaya tava pada pankaja stita duli sadrisham vichintaya. Stita duli, that my perfection is if I can just become a speck of dust at the lotus feet of the Lord. So what a mentality to think that, you know, this is just a cursory introduction. No, this is the lotus feet of the Lord appeared directly, as confirmed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And if the lotus feet of the Lord are there, we should give our full respects. That is the conclusion of the Shastra itself. So beyond that, we have this general thing, but for ISKCON devotees in particular, what is the special potency of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam? And Srila Prabhupada actually alludes to this when he was with his disciples on either the first or second trip to Vrindavan. There's a beautiful book called Vrindavan Days by Hayagriva Prabhu. And in that book, Srila Prabhupada very explicitly makes a comment. And mind you, this is in Radha Damodar, the place that Srila Prabhupada says, I eternally reside. That place where the six Goswamis are there eternally, the spiritual epicenter. So what is he stating about the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam? And his first canto in particular. So Srila Prabhupada says, so I wrote those first three volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, all of our philosophy, everything you need to know is in those first three volumes. I didn't go to America empty-handed. I went with the complete philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu written in these rooms, inspired by the Goswamis. That is what is pushing on our Krishna consciousness movement, right? So everything you need to know, the complete philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, inspired by the Goswamis. And that is what is pushing on this Krishna consciousness movement. So we began the class, and I began the class by glorifying the achievements of the Bodhisattva Bhaktivedanta Manu. This is a new chapter you've taken on the mantle. And we can see that what is pushed on the Krishna consciousness movement for, you know, the beginning of New Vrindavan, they didn't have the Krishna book. They didn't have the Chaitanya Charitamrita. They certainly didn't have the works of the Goswamis. They didn't even have the Bhagavad Gita. All they had was the first three volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam. And because they delved deep into the first three volumes of that first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and because they delved deep into that, they understood that in these purports is everything they need to know. This is inspired by the Goswamis. We don't need to go to necessarily to Krama Sandarbha and Tattva Sandarbha. If we approach the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam with the Bhaktivedanta purports in the right fashion. So let's seize this opportunity. Let's create another Hare Krishna explosion. And all we need, I'll give you a visual thing, are these three volumes in the first canto. So in the first canto, even it gives a suggestion, and this will lead me on to discussion of Parikshit Maharaj. The first canto, and Nishkinchana Chaitanya Prabhu gave a beautiful class last Friday on a wonderful verse, which was the Aham hi prishtoriyamano bhavadbir, achaksha atma vagmo trayavan, nabha patyantatma samam patatrinas, tata samam vishnu gatim vipashchitaha. O rishis who are as powerful as the sun, I shall try to describe to you the transcendental pastimes of Vishnu, as far as my knowledge allows. As the birds fly in the sky, as their capacity allows, so do the learned devotees describe the Lord as far as their realization allows. So the Bhagavatam is, the first canto is not comparing itself, as is usual, to a sindhu, to an ocean. You know, an ocean may seem vast, but it has predefined ends. You know, you start at one end of the ocean, you sail to the other. You start at the surface of the ocean, you go down. It may seem deep, but eventually you'll hit the bottom. The sky is what it's comparing itself to. It's comparing itself to the sky. There is no beginning. There is no end to the sky. You can travel forever in the sky. You can travel with unlimited depth in the sky. So in the same way, the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam has an unlimited depth and an unlimited breadth if we approach it in the proper mood. We need to worship that lotus feet, that those achyuta charan, those infallible lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, which have come as the first and second canto. And how do we worship? Well, Krishna gives a clue in Bhagavad Gita 18:70. He says, and I declare that he who studies this sacred conversation of ours worships me by his intelligence. Adyeshyate, studies. Jnana yagyena. We must engage in the jnana yagyena, the yagya of jnana, the yagya of intelligence. And if we apply our intelligence, if we deeply go into the first canto, bring out the principles, then we can do justice to the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam ki jay. So that leads us now on to this particular pastime. Srila Prabhupada has already mentioned in the purport that this is an astonishing pastime. It is astonishing. Why is it astonishing? Because Parikshit Maharaj is showing anger. And especially when you juxtapose Parikshit Maharaj reacting. And what has the sage actually done? Okay, the sage may not have followed the due protocol of etiquette, but he hasn't actually committed any offense as yet. And there's still a plausible explanation that he is deep in meditation. And then if we compare this to Parikshit Maharaj's reaction to the bull, Kali is killing the bull. He's breaking his fourth leg violently. There's a commission of act. And of course, Parikshit Maharaj's initial reaction is to kill. But then there is still some negotiation to be had. And what happens? He gives refuge to Kali. He at least takes the time to give refuge. But in this situation, we can see that Parikshit Maharaj is passing judgment. He is responding to this situation. And why is this why is this kind of astonishing? Well, Jiva Goswami mentions in his in the Krama Sandarbha, the meaning of Parikshit. Parikshit is actually a conjunction of two different words. One is pari, and the second word is ikshita. Pari ikshita. So pari ikshita iti Parikshit. Pari in this context means everything, all in all. And ikshita, ikshita tu, he is trying to observe everything. He is trying to go everywhere. Why? What is he trying to observe? He's trying to observe that form, that thumb-sized form of the Supreme Lord who he saw in the womb. He's searching everywhere, up, down, left, in every situation, physically, through his spiritual vision. He's looking for the Lord. So for him, that person on whose journey we are following Parikshit all the way to the 10th canto. If it would not have been for Parikshit in the first chapter of the 10th canto, the past sense of Krishna would not have been revealed. So he is the arrowhead from which we follow in behind. And how is it then that this great personality is on one hand giving refuge to a cow killer, and on another hand, he's getting angry with a brahmana? And that brahmana, mind you, Srila Prabhupada also says in the purport, is as good as Parikshit. He is not just, you know, bogey yogi, you know, X, Y, and Z, Baba. He is as good as Parikshit, and he is not giving him the benefit of the doubt. So many people would say, and then Prabhupada also mentions in the purport, that these situations are created by the Lord to make Parikshit Maharaj give up his family attachment, his connection with this world. And that's true. You know, we can see that as a result of this, things are put into place. This is a catalyst which leads to Sringi's curse, and then Janmajaya's coronation, and then Parikshit looking for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But why did Krishna have to arrange it in this way? You know, we say in our invocation every morning, Nashta preshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavate sevaya bhagavati uttama shloke bhaktir bhavati naishtiki. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam, by rendering service to the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed. And loving service unto the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. Parikshit is looking for the Lord. Why could the Lord not have arranged Shukadev Goswami to simply have gone to Hastinapur and speak? Or for Parikshit would have received him in open arms. It would have been a great festival. He would have heard the Bhagavatam. He would have achieved the perfection of his life by hearing Bhagavatam. Why did the Lord create a situation where Parikshit comes off looking or potentially undermining all of his kingly and good qualities? And I must have read again and again this chapter. Why does Parikshit act in that way to Kali? Why does Parikshit act in that way to the king? And the point is, at least from my limited perspective, and I even called up devotees in Vrindavan who are reading Srimad Bhagavatam and all sorts of tikas and commentaries, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Jiva Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, and they couldn't give me an answer. And my understanding is that this is the transcendental honey trap of the Lord. The transcendental honey trap, which sticks in our mind. And that no matter what, we have to keep on contemplating and contemplating. And there's many of these throughout the Puranic literatures. Look at Maryadat Purushottam, Sri Ramachandra. Maryadat Purushottam. The one who upholds the values of the Vedas, you know, who's upholds morality and etiquette. Maryadat Purushottam's own wife was put into a, Lakshmi Devi herself, through the Lord's arrangement and his pastime, was put into a position where people could have doubt as to her virtue. How could that ever be? This is Lakshmi Devi and this is Maryadat Purushottam. And still the citizens were given an opportunity to potentially speak like that. I think, why would the Lord do this? And even till today, people say, oh, Sita Devi, I won't go into it because I find it too offensive to talk about. But they'll still say, I've spoken to people, even despite the Shastric reference, they say, oh, no, Sita Devi's character is questionable. And then, you know, we take Krishna, Partha Sarathi. He was the chariot driver of Arjun in the most ferocious battle of all time. You can go to the Partha Sarathi temple in Chennai and you'll see the deity of Krishna has hallmarks in his chest. It's one of the Divya Deshams of Ramanujacharya. And the Pujari said to me, you see these holes in Krishna's chest? This is where he took the arrows from Bhishma Dev and from Dronacharya, because it wasn't just Arjun getting hit. It was Krishna was becoming hit as well. And these people were as strong as 10,000 elephants. And actually, on the call with us, we have some people from East Africa, so they'll know firsthand what it's like to see a giant bull elephant in Africa. I've seen a bull elephant knock over a car full of people, one elephant. And Krishna was being struck by people who were strong as 10,000 elephants. And yet that same Krishna arranges to leave the planet with an arrow from a hunter who was not even 1/10,000th of an elephant. Why? Why does the Lord do this? Parikshit Maharaj himself, he is saved from the son of the most powerful Brahmana, Ashwatthama, right? Who's son of Dronacharya, the guru of Arjun. And yet the Lord arranges that it is the immature son of a Brahmin boy, Shringi, who is the one whose curse. He's saved from a Brahmastra by the Lord, but then the Lord arranges for him to depart by the curse of a small Brahmin boy. So similarly, we see here, and these become perpetual topics of conversation, as is this one here. Why is it this duality in one sense? Why does the Lord arrange these pastimes with this duality? And I think I found my answer in Srila Prabhupada's purport. It was the beginning of this chapter. I think it's the 7th verse. And in that, Srila Prabhupada says, in the Vedas also, it is said by discourse on Lord Krishna's activities, one can get rid of all of the disadvantages of the age of Kali. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is also said that by the recitation of Srimad Bhagavatam, the Supreme Lord becomes at once arrested within one's heart. At once arrested when this discussion takes place. So 5,200 years later, we are still discussing this point. So the Lord has put these honey traps in there that lead us deeper and deeper. And if we imply our intelligence, if we jnana yajna, if we worship this first canto, these pastimes with our intelligence, we will be led down this rabbit hole. And ultimately the full benefit of Srimad Bhagavatam will awaken within us, you know, and it's not just for devotees. You can have people who are not even, they probably don't even believe in Krishna. But if you go into forums like Quora, there are still debates of people who is greater, Karna or Arjun, who is greater, Ram or Ravan. And people, you should see some of the Shastric references, Upanishads that I've never even heard of. They're reading, they're looking. They might be smoking a cigarette at the same time, but they're reading, they're looking, they're engaging in the Shastra because the Lord has created this honey trap. And maybe not in this life, but maybe some Sukriti will come by people engaging with the Shastra in this way. So I think that this pastime is one of those honey traps, this anger of Parikshit Maharaj, which Prabhupada calls astonishing. But alongside that, I think that this pastime also brings to the fore the point of etiquette. And we can see that the Lord does use his own pastimes and the pastimes of his devotees to draw out certain principles that we can learn from. We see Bharat Maharaj, you know, stage of Bhava, and he's just helping an animal. He's being compassionate to an animal. And still that attachment leads to an extra two birds. So the Lord uses that personality in that particular pastime to show that any kind of unnecessary attachment can hinder one's devotional development. And I feel that the Lord arranges it in this time, early on in the Srimad Bhagavatam, to show the importance of etiquette. Etiquette, culture, civilization, Varnasha, all of these things are linked. And if I have the time, I would like to talk about just how important etiquette is. I think we do have some time. Yeah, we've got a few minutes. So I'd like to talk about just how important etiquette is. And this is endorsed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as well. There's a very famous pastime in the Antya Lila. It's Antya 4, I think, Antya 4, where Sanatan Goswami, who is our Sambandha Acharya. So the Lord demonstrates the importance of etiquette and actually charges Sanatan Goswami for being responsible for this. So the pastime is that Sanatan Goswami has come to Jagannath Puri. And at that time, he ends up staying with Haridas Thakur. And one day, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to, he's staying with Haridas Thakur, and obviously Haridas Thakur is a very exalted soul, but neither can he, nor does he wish to go to the temple of Sri Jagannath. He considers himself too lowly. And in that vein, Sanatan Goswami also adopts a similar mood. He says, I'm too fallen to go anywhere near the temple of Jagannath. So the Lord wants to test Sanatan Goswami. Obviously, the Lord understands Haridas Thakur. Obviously, he understands Sanatan Goswami is the super soul within the heart, but at least for the benefit of all devotees in future. He wants to show that Sanatan Goswami is not simply mimicking Haridas Thakur in terms of his etiquette and his outlook. So one day, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu goes to have lunch in Yameshwara Tota. Yameshwara Tota is the garden outside of Tota Gopinath temple. Tota in Oriya, which is the language of Jagannath Puri, means garden. So he goes to Yameshwara Tota to have lunch. And this is in the month of May to June. So May to June in India is the hottest month of the year. It's the month just before monsoon. So it's blazing hot. And at the hottest month, at the hottest time of the day, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu calls Sanatan Goswami. It was noontime. And he says, please come and join me for prasad. Now, why does Chaitanya Mahaprabhu do this? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does this because from Sanatan Goswami's, Haridas Thakur's Petak, there are two roads. There is a road, the shorter road and the cooler road, which you can even walk down now, which goes past the Simhadwar of Jagannath Temple and off to Tota Gopinath, to Yameshwara Tota. And then there is the road, well, not even a road. You have to walk along the beach and then you go around the other way. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu set up this situation to see which route would Sanatan Goswami take. And Sanatan Goswami takes the longer and hotter road along the blazing hot sand. In fact, the sand is so hot that it describes it blisters all of Sanatan Goswami's feet. And then he arrives at Yameshwara Tota, but he doesn't feel any pain because he's just so excited to be there in the audience of the Lord. And in that moment, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu praises Sanatan Goswami because he can see that there is no duplicity. This isn't artificial. His surrender, his etiquette, and his feeling of humility for not going anywhere near Jagannath Temple, not even for fear of contaminating the temple, but for fear of contaminating the pujaris of the Lord. You know, if he would have walked the cooler route, he may have bumped into one of the pujaris, but his etiquette was so strong, his principles were so strong that he went the route of the beach. And after this pastime happens, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he says this verse, and this is a very famous verse, which is, Yada yadyapiyo tumi hao jagat pavan toma sparshe pavitra hoya deva munigan tatapi bhakta swabhava maryada rakshan maryada palana hoy sadura bhushan. My dear Sanatan, although you are the deliverer of the entire universe, and although even the demigods and great saints are purified by touching you, it is the characteristic of a devotee to observe and protect the Vaishnava etiquette. Maintenance of the Vaishnava etiquette is the ornament of a devotee, i.e. the etiquette of a devotee will beautify even his already most glorious qualities, the fact that he maintains etiquette in all circumstances. So at this point, Mahaprabhu basically anoints Sanatan Goswami as the Sambandha Acharya, the Acharya for establishing people's relationships. So both through Sanatan Goswami's writings, like Hari Bhakti Vilas, Digdarshini, there's also Sadachar Padhati. He shows through Sanatan Goswami's writings what is the proper behavior. But more than that, he many times acclaims Sanatan Goswami's personal example. In Bhakti Ratnakara, he says, Sanatan Goswami, you are my greatest devotee. Your behavior is the most exemplary. You are the dearest to me. And what is the behavior of Sanatan Goswami? Sanatan Goswami is not just very polite and decorous when in the company of Vaishnavas. No, Sanatan Goswami is well-behaved and exemplary in all different situations. In fact, many of you might know the Shad Goswami Astit. He's also known as Nirmatsaro Pujito. Nirmatsara Pujito, that one who is worshipped by all. Whether you're a ruffian, whether you are devotee, whether you're somewhere in between, he's attractive. His behavior is attractive. His demeanor is attractive in all circumstances. And he's not just in the temple in his own bubble. He was considered the father of Raj while he was on this planet. He would go and help people decide what crops they were going to sow. What was the best type of wheat? He would go and if there was a fallout between people in different villages, he would mediate. If there were people who were trying to get their children married, Sanatan Goswami would give a suggestion. So he was very much involved within the context of wider society. He wasn't just in this artificial bubble. So what was he trying to establish? He was trying to show how one's etiquette can ultimately become a culture. He was establishing a culture in Vraj. And by establishing this culture in people's mentality, by establishing this relationship with people, it facilitated his preaching. He was the Baba. He was the Sadhu Baba of all of the villages of Vrindavan. So what does this mean? When we have this, when devotees spread their influence into wider society, what are we actually trying to do? We're trying to reestablish Varanashram. And Sanatan Goswami's example shows how by reestablishing Varanashram, it facilitates our preaching. So there's much more I could say on that point, but the way in which I will try and wrap this point up and explain how this ties back into this verse is at the end of the previous chapter, Prabhupada said something very instructive. It was actually, I think it's the very last verse of the previous chapter and in his purport. And it's a bit lengthy, but I think it's worth hearing. The brahmanas and the sannyasis are expert in the spiritual advancement of society, whereas the kshatriyas or administrators are expert in the material peace and prosperity of human society. All of them are the pillars of all happiness, and therefore they are meant for full cooperation for common welfare. Okay, so that's the first point. So happy society has both spiritual advancement and material prosperity. If the common people are not receptive due to poor culture, it is very difficult to impress upon them the necessity of spiritual enlightenment. So the four regative principles prepare the ground for the reception of advancement in spiritual knowledge. So you must be, first of all, you must have spiritual and material prosperity. Second of all, you must have the culture, you must have the etiquette before you can talk about becoming a Vaishnava. And the third thing is that in other words, without state support, no doctrines of philosophy or religious principles can progressively advance. What is Prabhupada saying? Without state support, we cannot advance. To a certain extent, we can advance. But if Prabhupada then gives the example of Ashoka, Ashoka single-handedly turned the whole of Bharatvarsha, the home of the Vedas, to a Buddhist country. So the point being here that Varnashram is very important. What is Varnashram? Varnashram is a culture. What is a culture? Culture comes from two words. Culture comes from cultura. It's something which is cultivated. But what is cultivated? Cult. Cult comes from cultus. These are Latin words. Cultus means the etiquette of worship. The etiquette of worship amongst a group of people. So when the cultus is cultura, you have a culture. When the etiquette of worship, when the etiquette of behavior amongst wider society is cultivated, then you develop a proper culture. So etiquette is extremely important, because once that etiquette becomes a culture, that culture will become the fertile ground for the population to become spiritually advanced. So devotees sometimes say, you know, Varanashram is not so important. You know, Ramananda Roy, go further. True. For your own personal meditation on the Supreme Lord, of course, you are not bound to the confines of this world. But if you just, I'm sure a lot of you will want prasadam after this class. If you expect prasadam downstairs, you need to be dependent on wider society. There's got to be somebody growing the food, bringing the food, preparing the food. If you cut your arm and you want to go to the hospital, you're dependent on wider society to come and sew you up. You know, unless you want to go to Lechmore Heath and your cope in and, you know, take bath in the pond and whatever you can find in the fields to eat, you are dependent on wider society. And not just you, but our preaching mission is dependent on wider society. And the most explicit example I can give is when the manor was nearly closed down. Many of you may or may not remember this, but as a small boy, I remember the drive. If we wouldn't have got the state support and gone to parliament, the manor would have been closed. It's a fact. And look at Kazakhstan. I was there in 2007. They came in, they bulldozed the whole community of devotees because they didn't have state support. Our devotion individually may not be affected by it, but by establishing this wider culture, by adopting the state, only then can we fulfill Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prediction and take this Krishna consciousness to every town and village. Otherwise, we become bhajanandis. We're not integrated with our wider society, and we neglect that need. So in the interest of time, actually, that in itself could become a whole course on Vaishnava etiquette, and Bhakti Charamaraj and others have given a beautiful kind of breakdown of Vaishnava etiquette. Not breakdown, sorry, I should say, lengthy, elaborate expose of Hari Bhakti Vilas. But in conclusion, to recap, we've covered 3 points. The first point is that the first canto is non-different from the lotus feet of the Lord. And especially when decorated with Srila Prabhupada's purports, this is the complete philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So as us here in Bhaktivedanta Manor, we are starting a new chapter. Let us delve deep into this first canto. And I think that it's almost Krishna's arrangement that as we are going through this period of great upheaval, that we are now discussing every day the first canto and going deep into Srila Prabhupada's purports. So please, I urge you, and I also urge myself, to really take advantage of this first canto. The second point I made is that the Lord, in this pastime and in other pastimes, he creates intrigue to capture the interest of people. And in so doing, he allows us to receive the full mercy of the Srimad Bhagavatam and of the Puranic literatures. And third of all, is that the Lord's pastimes are often very instructive. They've got multiple layers. And the particular layer here is that etiquette is very important. Etiquette becomes a culture. Culture, godly culture, according to Varanashram, is the fertile ground from which spiritual consciousness can awaken all across the world. And in order for this to happen, there must be the cooperation between the brahmanas, the spiritualists, and the administrators. Together, they must work symbiotically to create this. Otherwise, we'll have a situation, as happens in this verse, that Parikshit Mara, the sage, transgresses the Manusamhita. So he is not upholding the culture. And then Parikshit Maharaj also forsakes his culture by becoming angry with the sage. And instead he facilitates Kali, which leads to the ruination, ultimately, of human civilization. Of course, the one rider is that when Parikshit Maharaj does this, Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken. But when we have mundane governments doing this, there is no Srimad Bhagavatam. Right? There is just ruination for the total population. So thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. If there are any questions, please send them through. What's the format now, Prabhu?
Thank you, Krishna Arjun Prabhu. Thank you for a wonderful class and that amazing summary of Canto 1, and also taking us back towards, at least from here in the ashram, towards West Virginia and that wonderful temple of Srila Prabhupada. It's actually invoked a lot of emotions and memories in our hearts, as we've from here in the ashram have also been there not so long ago. So thank you for that. And also reciting that Sankirtan story with our DMO Sutava Prabhu. That was very, very nice too. Very nice. So we do have one question. Yeah. And that is from Harika Mataji in the temple. She says, Hare Krishna Prabhuji Dandavat Pranam, brilliant class. Thank you for sharing your first-hand experience of Maharaj, His Holiness Bhakti Chara Maharaj, and Srila Prabhupada. My question is based on the idea of responsibility. How do we know we are responsible enough to take up responsibility, which is the first part? And ironically, a friend of hers from New Zealand asked this yesterday, is it true that once the disciple of Srila Prabhupada leave this earth, the mood of Prabhupada, the Prabhupada's Nugas, isms will be lost? Is it true? What are your thoughts on this? And then the third part of the question is, will we as the fourth generation grandchildren of Prabhupada be able to emulate responsibility disciples of Prabhupada, who are able to keep because we honestly do not feel qualified enough. So there's three parts to that question.
Okay. So the first part of the question, thank you very much for a very insightful question or questions. So the first part of the question is, how do we know if we are responsible enough to take on responsibility? And I think we don't. We don't. But the fact that you are asking the question, am I responsible enough? Am I qualified enough? This in itself is a good indication that most probably you are. Because Avaishiva doesn't consider him the self-doer in any situation. Srila Prabhupada even considered himself just a puppet in the hand of his spiritual master and the Supreme Lord. So having that mentality that I have no personal qualification, I have no personal ability, but all I have is one small desire to try and do something. Take on responsibility. Take on more responsibility than maybe you can cope. And as Srila Bhakti Charamara said, as many of the great acharyas said, you will find yourself having the capacity to do that and then take on more responsibility. Ramana Maharaj also said, to the extent that we take on responsibility, to that extent we will grow in spiritual life. So don't try and become, if you day two in the temple, don't become the temple president, but at least take responsibility for something and try and push yourself. Always feel that I'm slightly out of my comfort zone and I'm doing that for Srila Prabhupada and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We do it for work. Why can't we do it for Srila Prabhupada? And then you will find that somehow through Krishna's mercy, you do take care of things in this movement in a responsible way. Very nice point. Now, what's the second point? Prabhupada Nugism will be lost. Yes, this is a very, very essential point. Because, well, there are two things here. I think there was an initial flurry. You know, Srila Prabhupada was all that the devotees knew, right? Srila Prabhupada was all, he was the one tree giving shade to everyone. And since Srila Prabhupada's physical disappearance, I won't say disappearance because Prabhupada is saturated in every single thing that we do as Gaudiya Vaishnavas in ISKCON, there have been now there other trees which can also give some shade. So to a certain extent, you could say, okay, maybe Srila Prabhupada's position is being lost. But I remember we were in Tanzania once, and I was in Tanzania while traveling with Bhakti Charamaraj, and there was a mountain. And as you drove close to the mountain, it just seemed like a small hill, right? Because you were very close. You can't see the full extent. It's the small hill, and it was cloudy as well. But when the clouds dissipated, and as we drove further away from this mountain, we started to realize just how enormous that mountain was. As we got further away, the full perspective was given. And actually, there were small hills, but there was one giant hill which overshadowed them all. And that hill happened to be Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in Africa. So for some time, there was some kind of obstruction. There were other hills which seemed pretty big, but that true hill, its true enormity with perspective, when the clouds lifted, was really given. It was there for all to see. And I think that as time goes by, what Srila Prabhupada did, how he did it, you know, no email, no Zoom, no calls, no folio, you know, all these tikas, Sridhar Goswami, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Hari Bhakti Vilas, you know, Manu Sumita, I didn't get to that, but the Manu Sumita is also a reference within this purport. How did Prabhupada do all of that? How did Prabhupada have 10,000 disciples? How did Prabhupada travel the world 14 times in 10 years? How did Srila Prabhupada establish 108 temples? When devotees who are sincere look at that, Prabhupada Nugism will reach a height that probably will only be matched by his immediate disciples. I have full faith in that. If you are sincere and you get the proper perspective, the clouds will lift and you will see Srila Prabhupada's position. And the final thing, fourth generation.
About being qualified enough.
So have I answered that? Have I answered?
I think you've answered that.
Thank you for a wonderful question, Mataji.
And there's a comment by Chandra Chaitanya Prabhu talking about beautiful class and how he's assured And ISKCON is assured that the future is bright in terms of obviously the younger generation in within ISKCON is taking responsibility and spreading this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission and word, all glory to Srila Prabhupada. So, I mean, to add to that, we have during this lockdown period, you mentioned about how the community here at Bhaktivedanta Manor have galvanized around in order to ensure all the services are taken care of. And we've actually got a really nice youth group here from Pandasena, from devotees around, even from Zurich, Africa, etc., in that they are really eager and amazingly talented in many, many things that they do. In fact, yesterday we had Shripad Ayendra Prabhu's festival here at the manor. It was like a very small thing, but it was, you know, something internal that we wanted to do and actually have that kirtan on his behalf. And we felt because of the enthusiasm of this youth and all the Pandasena team, everyone, it's just testament to the generation that is actually coming forward. And you're right when you say that this is Prabhupada has established this entire creation, this entire house of ISKCON, which will definitely bring about that change within this 10,000 years of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Thank you so much for your wonderful class, Prabhu.